This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It's certainly no secret that nearly all politicians prefer some media outlets to others. And it's no secret that the president hates nearly all of the media, with one big exception. Donald Trump loves Fox News, and he tweets its praises all the time. But something big and something quite rare in modern times happened between Fox and the president during the midterm campaign.
Sean Hannity, come on up. Sean Hannity.
Hannity appeared at a rally not as an observer, not as a commentator, but as a speaker on the podium for the president.
I did an opening monologue today, and I had no idea you were going to invite me up here. And the one thing that has made and defined your presidency more than anything else: promises made, promises kept.
It seems the president trusts Sean Hannity and others on the Fox News evening lineup more than he trusts his own advisors. Jane Mayer has been reporting for us on how this unique relationship came about. I spoke with Jane last week, and days later, we got an important update. White House Deputy Chief of Staff and former head of Fox, Bill Shine, resigned from the White House, and he's going to work on Trump's 2020 campaign. That just happened on Friday. Here's my conversation with Jane Mayer. Jane, you've described a relationship between Fox News and the Trump administration that goes well beyond mutual admiration. You say there's a significant coordination happening there. What do you mean by that?
Well, I set out to try to figure out what was going on with this because Bill Shine, who used to be the president of Fox News, had been appointed to be a deputy chief of staff to Trump and director of White House communications. And so he had the prominent job in the White House over the president's message. You know, how does that work? And tried to kind of dig beneath the surface there. And what I found was there are layer after layer after layer of interlocking connections between the White House and 21st Century Fox. So I was trying to figure out who sets the tune, who, you know, that everybody plays during the course of the day. If the news on Fox is all about some kind of caravan, supposedly, of immigrants invading America, whose idea is that? And it turns out it just is this continual feedback loop back and forth, because the most prominent and well-paid and highest-rated opinion host on Fox is Sean Hannity, and he's on the phone virtually every night after his show, he has told people, with President Trump. There's a message coordination that I've never seen in other White Houses. And, you know, I go back to having covered Reagan and other people who've been studying presidencies, historians and political scientists. They say that this is new.
Well, Ben Bradley, who went on to be the great editor of the Watergate era, when he was at Newsweek, was best friends with John F. Kennedy. At the 1960 Democratic Convention, Phil Gramm, the owner of the Washington Post, brokered the relationship and the nomination of Lyndon Johnson as vice president to John Kennedy. Walter Lippmann, the great newspaper columnist and pundit, saw it as his role to advise presidents at a certain point in history. What's the difference now?
Well, what we've got here is the single largest cable television network in America. It's not just a single evening of brokering a convention or a visit behind the scenes with the president, as Ben Bradley did, or going horseback riding with him or whatever they did. This is like a daily operation. And so it's become an arm of the White House. That's what's really different.
The interesting thing in your piece is that the relationship was not always like this. What's the history of this relationship and how did it evolve?
Yeah, it was interesting. There's much more than I knew before getting into this, a kind of a rocky start to this romance. Basically, Rupert Murdoch had known Trump for decades, going back to when he bought the New York Post. They were introduced to each other by Roy Cohn. And they had a kind of a symbiotic business relationship from the start. Trump could get publicity for his celebrity sort of antics, and Rupert Murdoch could sell papers.
But isn't it true that Rupert Murdoch considered Donald Trump a sleazy businessman?
That is what I'm told by people who know Murdoch well. They thought he was sort of a shady casino operator and kind of a con artist. So when you finally get to the point of 2016 and Trump is running for real for the White House, Rupert Murdoch was very tough on him. His newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, described it as a catastrophe for the Republican Party and for the country to have Trump running. And Rupert Murdoch personally tweeted against Trump on the issue of immigration. So what interested me was, how do you get from there to the point where every night almost, the hosts that are reaching a huge swath of America are trashing immigrants and scaring people about immigration? And you've got this, you know, Fox is the chairman of the company is Rupert Murdoch, an immigrant himself from Australia who thinks immigration is a good thing. And so I was curious, you know, how does he square that? And I interviewed a lot of people, and one of them on the record, Greta Van Susteren, who used to be a host of a show at CNN and then at Fox and MSNBC. So she's seen them all. She said, don't kid yourself. What he cares about is the bottom line. And they are minting money by whipping up fear.
Now, one of the central figures in all of this, as you said, is Bill Shein, who's a former co-president of Fox News, currently White House Director of Communications and Deputy Chief of Staff. Now, you lay out at great length Bill Shein's history at Fox and his relationship with Roger Ailes, who was the kind of mind and executive for so many years behind Fox News and then was forced out on charges of sexual harassment. What was the relationship between Shein and Ailes, and what was their argument when it had to do with Trump?
Well, so Shein was the deputy to Roger Ailes. He'd come into Fox basically as the producer for Sean Hannity. He and Sean Hannity are best friends. Their families are very, very close. And he kind of rode Hannity's coattails and worked his way up at Fox. His critics say he was an enabler, a gopher, somebody who covered up the endless numbers of sexual harassment accusations that were lodged against Roger Ailes. Shein has said he refused to talk to us. He's not talking to anybody really in the press, but he had said through a spokesman that he didn't know anything about the sexual harassment charges against Ailes.
Is that possibly true?
It's, you know, if it is possibly true, I mean, almost anything's possibly true. It is true that Roger Ailes was a very secretive, paranoid man, but it kind of stretches credulity in many ways because, among other things, I have a document, which is Bill Shein signing a $3.15 million agreement with one of the women who was sexually harassed by Roger Ailes.
This is the booker named Lori Loon.
Her name is Lori Loon, and you have to wonder, what did Bill Shein think was going on that they were paying this woman $3.15 million to stay quiet and go away?
Jane, you have one source that said that Shein would do this. He would talk to the women with a kind of velvet glove approach, saying, don't worry about it, these allegations of sexual misconduct. And if that didn't work, he'd warn her that it would ruin her career.
That's the quote in the story, and I have to say, that's only one quote I heard like this. There were so many people and so many women I talked to who have in the past worked at Fox who said there was almost like a routine, a system. You would complain to your supervisor, then you would complain on up the structure till Bill Shine, who would kind of tell you, oh, it's no big deal, just forget about it. And then eventually it would become, you know, it's not going to be good for you to make a big fuss over this. And they would even call the agents sometimes.
Well, it seems quite incredible that the White House then, that Donald Trump then would take the risk of appointing Shine director of communications and deputy chief of staff, knowing that this was going on at Fox News. How can that help him?
Well, I mean, and even beyond that, this behavior of Bill Shine's and Roger Ailes was the subject of a criminal investigation by the U.S. attorney in New York, which was looking into payoffs by Fox to silence the women and efforts to intimidate the women. How did this happen that he wound up in the White House? Sean Hannity put him there. Sean Hannity introduced him to President Trump, arranged a private dinner, and pushed very hard to get him into the White House.
Jen, you seem to imply, and you say it straight out in a way, that the President of the United States is getting a great deal of his information from Fox, maybe even more than the information he's getting from his own intelligence agencies.
Well, this is what his own advisors tell me. A number of them suggested that if you want to try to reach President Trump, the best thing to do is get on Fox News. So even though he's got his advisors right there around him in the Oval Office, that he respects the people that he sees on television. There's a Senate aide, for instance, who's interviewed in the story, who talks about how a very prominent Republican senator, whose name I know, but I'm not allowed to say in the middle of the story because he didn't want to be identified. But when he wants to reach President Trump, he calls up Fox News, asks one of the friendly hosts to put him on. He goes on, makes his points, and he says by the time that he's getting his makeup off in the green room afterwards, the phone is ringing and it's President Trump.
Now, Jen, you've got some startling things in this story. One of them is that a FoxNews.com reporter had the Stormy Daniels story solid before the election. What happened?
So this was really interesting to me because you begin to see how Fox begins to really take the side of Trump. And one of the most important things that I hadn't known was that they had the Stormy Daniels story. A young reporter named Diana Falzone had it. And she had been working on it since March 2016. By October 2016, so right before the election, she was trying very hard to get this on the air. And she'd seen emails back and forth between Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, and the people representing Stormy Daniels, the porn actress with whom Trump had allegedly had an affair. And she'd seen the contract between them for hush money. And she also realized at a certain point, it appears, that there was a catch and kill thing going on with the National Enquirer, where they were silencing the woman by buying her story and killing it. And so she was, this young reporter for Fox was pushing this, and she kept getting kind of the runaround. Finally, she reached the top editor for the website, a man named Ken LaCourte. And according to what she told her colleagues, and I've checked this with them, she said that his answer was, good reporting, kiddo. But he said, you know, Rupert Murdoch wants Donald Trump to win. So just set it aside.
So just died. Killed the story in a sense.
They killed it. They shelved it. Yeah. Let's just say, for fairness, Ken LaCourte has denied that ever saying that. He agrees he killed the story, but he claims he didn't say that.
Another piece of information that you've got that's remarkable to me. You focus on the Justice Department's attempt to block AT&T from purchasing CNN's parent company, Time Warner. How did this play out within the Trump White House? Describe the scene. What happened?
So this is a scene that takes place in the Oval Office in the late summer of 2017. Gary Cohn is there with the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly.
Gary Cohn, the economic advisor to President Trump at that time.
That's right. And Trump is just really exasperated with Cohen. He says to Kelly, who's just become his chief of staff, I've told him 50 times to block that deal. I want him to call the Justice Department and get them to file suit. It's time to block that deal. We know that Trump was opposed to this deal because it was very good for CNN, basically. He's made that much clear in public statements. But he promised the public that he was not going to intervene. It would be very improper for a president to try to put his thumb on the scale of justice in such a situation to help a friend and hurt a foe. But what we found out is that, in fact, he ordered his top economic advisor to do just that.
Now, he was acting also in the interest of Rupert Murdoch. Why would that be?
Well, because Rupert Murdoch was the rival to Time Warner, which owns CNN. Rupert Murdoch's company doesn't want to see Time Warner become more powerful by allying itself with a huge company like AT&T, you know, and so he wanted to see it blocked as well, I would assume. But I've got to say, Murdoch's people declined to speak on the record to us about it.
Rupert Murdoch is not a young man. He's in his late 80s. It's known that his children are not wild about certain aspects, certainly, of Fox News, except for the aspect that it makes billions of dollars a year in profit. What do you expect will happen to Fox News when Rupert Murdoch is gone?
Well, it's a great question. I don't have the answer. I think it's going to hang on Lachlan Murdoch, probably. He's the son, the oldest son of Rupert, who is going to be the top person overseeing Fox News with his father. And he shares his dad's politics. I think he's quite conservative. But I have heard that people at Fox seem to think that maybe he'll make it slightly more center-right. James Murdoch, who's much more of a political independent, is not going to be involved. He has sort of opted out of all of this. And the thing is, it makes so much money like this for them. I'm just not sure they're going to want to do anything that hurts the golden goose.
How are the Trump presidency and the future of Fox News linked to each other? How do you expect to see the campaign covered?
Well, I mean, one thing that is a danger for Trump is that the Fox base viewership needs to be enraged in order to keep the business model working. But it's not necessarily great for Trump to only reach those people. He can get cornered by his own allies, and it's happened before. It happened on the budget deals, where he wound up, in an effort to sort of please Fox, he wound up doing things that really hurt his own popularity. And that could happen again in the campaign. He may find it hard to broaden the base the way he needs to get reelected if he's only narrowcasting his message to the most extreme people who are just watching Fox.
It's a remarkable piece of reporting. Jane Mayer, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
You can find Jane Mayer's reporting on Fox News and the Trump administration at NewYorker.com. I reached her in Washington. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. In 1970, two Black Panthers fled the United States, and for nearly 50 years, they've made a life in exile. We're telling that story in two parts. And if you missed part one of their story last week, you can find it at newyorkerradio.org. And staff writer Jelani Cobb will bring us part two in just a moment. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to NetSuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at the magazine. We're going to pick up our story, American Exiles in East Africa. Last week, we met Pete O'Neill, a former street hustler who became the head of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panther Party, and Charlotte Hill, a high school student who gave up a college scholarship to do community service with the Panthers. In 1970, Pete O'Neill was convicted on what he considered to be trumped-up charges related to transporting a firearm.
And then he said, oddly, but I'll allow you to stay out on bail. And that was the funniest thing. I could not understand why he did that. Now, you know, you've seen enough crime movies. When they sentence you, they put the handcuffs on you and they take you away.
Pete was suspicious, afraid he was being set up.
One day I was at the YMCA. This policeman came in and he said, I want to talk to you. I said, man, I don't have anything to talk to you. And he looked at me and he started crying. And he said, Pete, they're going to kill you. He said, they're going to kill you and ain't a damn thing I can do about it.
Our producer, Kalalia, has been reporting Pete and Charlotte's story for much of the last year. We'll pick up the story there.
Pete and Charlotte decided to make a run for it. Pete would be jumping bail and fleeing a conviction. It was extremely risky, and the police were watching.
We were under 24-hour surveillance every day. There were helicopters that would fly around and shine lights in our bedroom window to harass us. There was police cars outside of our apartment building who would have 8-hour shifts.
They would get a ride from Kansas City across the state to St. Louis, where they would board a plane for New York. The plan was this. At midnight, a friend would call and say,
hey, man, I'm getting ready to turn in now. I'll see you tomorrow.
That meant the car was ready for them.
We, of course, had to be in disguise.
We were trying to look like a newlywed couple. I had a suit and a tie, and Charlotte had a wig and a fur coat.
I had gotten this cashmere coat with a little mink collar and had on my makeup, and I borrowed my sister's wig. That wig was itchy, and I wasn't used to that because here I'd been wearing a natural for a very long time.
But to get out of the country, first, they'd have to get out of the building.
Now, the apartment building we lived in was unique. There were three apartment buildings in a row. Okay, the police were watching the apartment building we were in. But that if you went down in the basement of that apartment building, there was a passageway to the next apartment building. And if you're in that, you could go to...
On a cold night in November, Pete and Charlotte sat in their bedroom fully dressed with the lights off and waited for the call.
Midnight came, no phone call. 1 o'clock came, 2 o'clock came.
And we was like, this ain't gonna happen. So I'd taken off my itchy wig and he had taken off his clothes and we were like, I don't know what's gonna happen after that, but it doesn't look like we're gonna escape.
It was almost 3 o'clock in the morning when the phone rang.
Hey, man, I'm getting ready to turn in now. I'll see you tomorrow.
It was go time. They made their way down to the basement farthest from their place and stepped outside into the alleyway. They crawled on their hands and knees into the trunk of a getaway car.
It was very, very hectic, and when we were getting in the trunk of that car, I remember I knocked my knee. And we were able to get out at some point and get in the car.
as we start to enter St. Louis, dawn is breaking. Every car you looked at, they looked as if each one was staring at it. I said, oh, God.
They arrived at the airport with a small wad of cash, their best clothes on their backs, and fake IDs to get on the plane.
We weren't supposed to call each other by our names. I can remember both of us stumbling in our conversations, and I would call him Pete, and he would call me Charlotte, and we'd have to remind each other not to do that.
But they made it to New York without a problem, and they connected with members of the Communist Party of New York, who put them up in a safe house.
We stayed there for a few days. There was comrades who were helping us there, and they were a part of the Underground Railroad.
And the plan was we would go to Sweden, and then we'd try to make our way to Algeria.
But the comrades may have been a little nervous about the Kansas City fugitives they were hiding.
I saw a note that we weren't supposed to see. It said, you got to be careful with these guys, because you know they're coming from, like, Dodge City, and they might be packing. Charlotte and I didn't have a fork between the two of us.
They were given their new documents, and they took a taxi to the airport. It suddenly hit them. They were leaving their home country and had no idea when they'd be back.
I remember the last song that we heard was Michael Jackson singing I'll Be There.
I'll be there. I said, Charlotte, I said, we need to remember that. That's going to be our song from now on. We get to the airport. And when we get in, I said, Charlotte, listen, sister, you really don't have to do this. I said, you can go back. Nobody's looking for you. You can go on with your scholarship and go on. You can go on and do this if this is what you want to do. And she said, no, Brother Chairman, I'm down for doubles. I'm ready for this. I'm not. I said, let's go. And we headed north on our way to Sweden.
Why Sweden?
Well, Sweden, remember, think about that now. There were so many draft evaders there who were not being returned to the United States. A lot of people there. So we thought we had a better chance.
A communist youth group helped them find a place to stay just outside of Stockholm.
They didn't know us from Adam, but they welcomed us into their commune when they found out we was Panthers and all that, you know. They, like, slept on mattresses on the floor, and you would have all these comforters, and everybody would have what you call a kokolon.
That's a kind of stove or heater.
But the people really welcomed us. They really, really did. And very progressive people.
I didn't know white people like those people existed. They took us into their hearts. They took us into their homes. This was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
They were there for nearly 6 months before they continued their journey. When it was time to say goodbye, their Swedish host wanted to see them off at the airport.
We'll go to the airport with you. I said, oh, but you can't. I said, we're getting on the bus. I think it's just for people who, this is an airline bus. They said, no, we'll ride our bicycles. It's 900 degrees below zero. It had to be. No place could be that cold. No place. They said, we'll ride our bicycles. And they did. They rode bicycles all the way to the airport to see us off.
Like, motor bicycles?
No, heck no. I'm talking about pumping bicycles.
Charlotte and Pete were headed to Algeria to join a group of Black Panthers who had relocated there. In the late 60s, the second Algerian president, Waré Boumediene, offered a home to armed anti-colonial groups all over the world. It included housing plus a generous monthly stipend. The ANC of South Africa, the PLO, the IRA, and other groups had members operating in Algeria. Eldridge Cleaver, the Panthers' Minister of Information, took up Boumediene's offer, setting up an international Panther headquarters. Pete and Charlotte, along with several other Panthers, joined him. For the first time, they experienced not just camaraderie from other radicals, but official recognition.
The 2 years that we stayed in Algeria was beautiful.
Beautiful how?
It was beautiful in that this feeling of camaraderie with not only Panthers, but other freedom fighters who was there was very, very strong. And we were actually treated as an embassy. We could bring in cars, you know, without duty, bring in people easily. We were even allowed to have our weapons, all of that, just like an embassy.
But there were some real cultural differences. And the longer the Panthers stayed, the more this became an issue.
We were very naive in understanding the importance of being in an Islamic society. Most of us had never experienced that. And here we were wearing miniskirts, you know, where the Muslim sisters there, they might have miniskirts on under their hijabs, you know, but they were draped down. We would be walking through the streets and men would be harassing us. And I think most of us thought it was just racism. But in hindsight, it was the way we were looking, in miniskirts, you know, in a society where all the women were supposed to be very modest.
And then the issue started getting even more personal.
The Algerian women were very drawn to the brothers. So many of them would come to the headquarters and, you know, try to catch and try to be girlfriends of the, and the community did not like that. So where we had good relations with the government, with the community, it wasn't good.
That's Charlotte O'Neill talking about her time living as a Black Panther in Algeria. Our story, American Exiles in East Africa, continues in a moment. I'm Jelani Cobb, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. I'm David Remnick.
And I'm Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at the magazine. You're listening to American Exiles in East Africa, a story produced for the New Yorker Radio Hour by Kala Leah. It's about Charlotte and Pete O'Neill, two members of the Black Panther Party who went into exile during the years that the Panthers were being persecuted by the U.S. government. Earlier, we heard how Pete and Charlotte fled Kansas City in disguise. They made their way to Algeria, where the Panthers had set up an international headquarters. Politically, the country welcomed leftist radicals. But as Americans of the 1960s, they came to find Algeria stifling.
And so is that one of the reasons why you decided to leave? Why did you decide to go to Tanzania at that point?
Well, you know, we saw that we would never probably be able to be real comfortable there and raising our child there.
Charlotte and Pete's son was born in Algeria. By 1973, many exiled Black Panthers had left the country. Charlotte and Pete among them.
More and more brothers and sisters who were already in Tanzania started telling us, y'all need to come here. It's a socialist government. President Nyerere, through his ambassador, had already put out the word that you know, if you were into nation building, especially Africans from the diaspora, that you would be welcome.
As the nation's first president, Julius Nyerere implemented an economic program that many labeled socialist. He introduced a policy of collectivization in the country's agricultural system.
Julius Nyerere was the first president of Tanzania after it gained independence from Great Britain in 1961. He was one of the primary architects of something called African socialism. Under that banner, there were black people from around the world united in an effort to reverse the economic exploitation of colonialism.
First and foremost, the peasant, because he's the producer of the food for the majority of the population of any country in Africa at present. So first of all, take the peasant and treat him as a god.
From 1968 to 1974, Tanzania was home to the highest population of African Americans in East Africa, an estimated 800 people. They were affectionately known as Wa Afro, meaning the people who wore afros.
It was 1972, and once again, Charlotte and Pete were in search of a new home. In Tanzania, they were greeted at the airport in Dar es Salaam by another Black Panther and people from back home in Kansas.
And I remember the day we got off the plane, and they had a beach house, and they took us to that beach house. And I can remember they had all this pineapple. I never tasted pineapple like that, all kind of fruits, and they made us so welcome. There was a poster that had been made of Brother Pete and myself. And when I saw that poster, here we are in Tanzania, and that poster is there, I said, man, we supposed to be here, you know.
What did the poster have on it?
It's Brother Pete holding a gun, I think it's a rifle, and I'm standing a little behind him, and I'm like holding my hand on his hand.
Right away, Charlotte embraced Tanzania as her new home. But Pete was uneasy. It felt too far from everything he knew. And the weather in Dar es Salaam, the heat was overwhelming. Unlike in Algeria, the Tanzanian government wasn't offering any financial support. Pete and Charlotte were going to be on their own. Tanzania is a huge country, twice the size of California. It has a coastline along the Indian Ocean for more than 800 miles. In the northeast, it's lush, rich with wildlife and beautiful birds. After they had been in Dar es Salaam for over a year, they found some land to rent in the north, on a coffee farm. They loved the landscape and the cooler climate. They bought a few cows, some pigs, rabbits, and eventually 1,000 chickens.
And that was our first experience with growing our own food and raising animals. It was so scary because you have to sit on a very low stool and that cow looks big as an elephant.
After nearly 6 years of renting, a friend gifted them about 4 acres of land nearby in a village called Mbaseni, not far from Mount Kilimanjaro. They had been in limbo for practically a decade, in Sweden, in Algeria, Dar es Salaam, and on a coffee farm. In Mbaseni, they finally had a place to call home, and they started building. First, they built a house for the family. By then, their second child was born, a girl.
Clearing the land, making our own bricks. We had plastic on the windows, and I used to be so proud of the calluses in my hands, you know, because that identified me as a worker, and I've always had a lot of pride in being a worker.
But what they had in mind was much larger than a house. Pete and Charlotte had dreamed of building some kind of center to serve the community. They wanted to continue the work they had been doing back home with the Panthers. They named the project the United African Alliance Community Center, or UAACC. Mostly they call it the center.
About 5 minutes from the house.
To get to the center, you drive a mile or so up a seriously bumpy, unpaved road. It's better if you have a four-wheel drive. At the entrance, there are huge metal doors with the center's name in red, black, and green. Another Black Panther who used to live nearby donated $15,000 to put a freshwater tap outside the gate, which means anyone can fetch water at any time of the day. And that was a big deal for this village. And on the door, there's a small painted picture of a Black Panther, the party's logo, plus a message.
We will never tolerate a hungry child in our presence. We never have and never will, period. From 1966 to 2018 and onwards, the struggle continues. And it's a picture of a Black Panther image on the side.
The center's a combination of a school, a library, a YMCA, and an orphanage. Inside, you can usually find Pete fussing with the kids.
Okay, I'm Sanga, and this is the UACC, United African Alliance and Community Center.
So what is this building here?
Yeah, this is the English class. We usually conduct our class there. Also, yoga is down there, the very same class, and other activities.
The buildings are made from cement, but they're very colorful, painted with murals of African and African-American leaders. They're connected by gravel paths, lined with vibrant sculptures. And all around are trees, banana, mulberry, and avocado. There's also a vegetable garden. It's cared for by the children. And of course, there's a basketball court.
So tell me what this building over here. This building.
Okay, that one is the art class. Yeah, that's art class.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and what about this one?
That also is an English class also. Yes, because you have beginner's English and intermediate English. So this is for beginners and that's for intermediate class. Also for computer, that's also doing some practice there.
Okay.
Yeah. Here we have different programs. We have carpentry, we have engineering.
Africa. The center also functions as an orphanage. Between 2008 and 2010, they took in about 20 children from around Embassini Village. The village chairman helps choose the kids who need the most support.
Okay, we had Irene, who was the first graduate. She was always number one in her classes. She's now going to college. There's Amisi.
Miriam. This is Selamani.
There's Halima.
That's Joyce. This is Aaliyah, the boy that came here, the big boy that came here earlier when he got out of school.
Omari, he's the electrician.
Now, this is Miriam, so I don't know who this other one I said was Miriam is. This is Jackie, and this is Felix.
And there's usually college students around. Charlotte and Pete have been hosting groups from all over the world for almost 30 years.
Where the rest of the group does?
Where's the rest of the group? They're not here yet.
Oh, they're not?
No.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Anyway, glad to have you all back.
Thank you very much.
Glad to be here. How you doing?
In the main dining hall, at the center of the compound, there's a large frame poster on the wall of Charlotte and Pete. The picture first appeared in a Kansas City newspaper before they left the United States. Pete is holding a rifle, and Charlotte is standing by his side. It's a reminder of how they got there. Pete still has a rifle. He keeps it for security and for the occasional wild animal. He seems like a much different man. Different than the street hustler he was in the early 60s, and different from the Black Panther he became.
when people speak about the Black Panther Party, they put an emphasis on confrontation, guns, and things of that nature. And of course, that did happen. We were not a nonviolent organization, and we believed in meeting violence with violence. That was our foundational belief. The confrontations, the berets, the guns were not the crown, the jewel in the crown of the Black Panther Party. That would be the community work that we did. That is what gives me the greatest pride.
It was while working on the Black Panther's Free Breakfast for School Children program, back in Kansas City, where Charlotte and Pete had fallen in love.
Again, it's almost like a full circle situation where, you know, the Breakfast for School Children is still going on, except it's going on in this village, yeah, you know.
Yeah. Mm. Do you think you could do the kind of work that you're doing here in the United States? Do you think it actually would be possible that you would have the resources, the support?
I'm prone to say I don't think it would have been possible, or it would have been very, very difficult. For one reason, it's because of the land. It's not easy to get land in America, you know. And I think we would have been completely different people. You know, the fact that we have lived here for so long, I think that draws people to want to visit, to want to support, you know, the fact that we were Panthers and where we have carved out this bit of paradise in the middle of an African village. You know, people are very drawn to that. So I'm not sure if that could have happened in a similar way if we had stayed in Kansas City.
On some small scale, Pete and Charlotte O'Neill have realized the goals outlined by Bobby Seale and Huey Newton in their original vision for the Black Panther Party, something they could not have done in the climate of racial hostility in the United States of the 1960s. We've learned conclusively that the FBI harassed and targeted the Black Panthers. But the legacy of radical activism of the 1960s remains unsettled, even a half century later. In 1998, Pete filed a petition to have his conviction overturned. It was denied. And a petition for a pardon that was sent to President Obama went nowhere. Pete is near 80 now and doesn't expect he'll ever see America again.
I'd like to think that home is here. I know I feel very, very comfortable here, but sadly, or perhaps tragically, there's still a part of me, perhaps only in my mind, that is on 12th Street that doesn't exist anymore, in Kansas City.
Charlotte, since she was never charged with any crime, continues to go back and forth. She speaks to American students like she was doing when I met her at Howard University 30 years ago, and she raises money for the United African Alliance Community Center.
Howdy. Slala.
The week I spent at the center was an especially busy one because Pete and his helpers were renovating a room for Charlotte's elderly father, Mr. Hill.
His internet connection, we just got hooked up today. His Vonage telephone, so his friends can call him from the state. And I'm going to have this on. I'm going to have Netflix on the TV. I'm going to have everything set up there.
Mr. Hill spent his whole life in Kansas City. He's in his 90s now. And he's finally accepted Charlotte's offer to spend his last years in Tanzania. It's a big moment for this family.
Well, we've arrived at Kilimanjaro Airport, and we're waiting for the plane to come in. I'm not sure if it has or not, but we've come with two cars so we can carry Charlotte and Mze, and then the other car can carry the luggage. Chaza.
Good. How are you?
I'm very good.
How was the trip?
How was the trip?
Beautiful.
Great, great.
Good trip.
Yes, good to see you.
Is Pete here?
Oh, there he is.
Kissy, kissy.
How you doing?
I know you,
I know you did. How you doing?
You. It's good to be here. Woo! And to see this old man.
Here I am.
Do you realize we have our 50th anniversary next year?
That's what he said.
50 years.
How in the world do you stand each other?
Hey.
That's not the question. The question is, how in the world has she put up with me? Yes, sir.
I'm glad that you met this young lady.
Well, that's what you say now. That's what you said now, but that isn't what you said back then.
I know it. Mal has that. We're home.
Yes. Yeah,
As we drive up to the center, a man walks into the middle of the road wearing a tribal mask. He stops the car. Then all of a sudden, we're surrounded by a crowd of people. Some are singing and others are waving and smiling. I'm as surprised as Mr. Hill is. Neither of us know it, but Pete has invited traditional artists to welcome Mr. Hill to his new home. I couldn't stop thinking about how different this was from America, and how much more respect is paid to elders here. Mr. Hill has tears in his eyes. He's leaning forward, holding on to the seats. He reminds me of a boy who can't wait for his next adventure.
You know, I think if he had ended up in a nursing home, that probably would have took him out of it, you know, because he's such a people person, and he thrives on being around people and being sometimes center of attention and all of that, you know. So I vowed to my ancestors, and I vowed to my brother and sisters and the rest of the family. I said, Dad is going to be happy for the rest of his days, and he's going to have fun.
You've been listening to American Exiles in East Africa, produced by Kalalia. I'm Jelani Cobb, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with much more on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Our story, American Exiles in East Africa, was produced with assistance from Meja Mbuya in Tanzania. Additional music was contributed by Sidi Matale, Kiva, and L.D. Brown. The story draws on Seth Markle's book called A Motorcycle on Hell Run, Tanzania, Black Power, and the Uncertain Future of Pan-Africanism, 1964 through 1974. The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.